Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick. And today's movie on Weird House Cinema is the 1991 fantasy epic Beastmaster 2 Through the Portal of Time. Continuing a tradition we've started on the show of covering the second movie in a series without covering the first. We have never discussed Beastmaster. In fact, I don't know if I've ever even seen it all the way through.
What, but the first Beastmaster?
I think I've seen like half of it.
Oh, it's really good. I feel like I can say without any doubt that the original Beastmaster from Don Coscarelli is just a solid leather diaper movie. It's a solid barbarian wasteland Conan-esque motion picture with some awesome monsters in it, some fun performances, and a great villain played by Rip Torn.
Well, fair enough. If Beastmaster 1 is your idea of solid, I would say Beastmaster 2 is riven with holes. It's like Swiss cheese, maybe about to crumble apart. But I had a good time revisiting this because I remember this movie in that it used to play on TV when I was a kid. I think this is one of those ones that come on TNT late at night or maybe in the middle of the afternoon on a weekend. And so the reason we picked this movie is that, Rob, we were talking about examples of this bizarre subgenre that existed from roughly the mid-80s to the early 90s. And the subgenre was this. You take your leather diaper barbarian or some other greased up fantasy muscle man who, exists in a world of swords and magic. And then you have him travel from his strife-torn home world to the smog-filled alleyways of modern-day Los Angeles. Surprisingly, there was more than one movie with this premise. So I would say it's a variant on the standard fish-out-of-water plot, coming pretty close to the format that we talked about in our episode on the Nicholas Meyer movie Time After Time, the format we were calling Fish Out of Time, except in the case of these movies in particular, the Beef Warrior is typically said to be traveling from some other dimension filled with wizards and demons rather than just from a point in Earth's real past. And I don't
you can make an argument, though, that if science fiction is our imagined future, fantasy is our imagined past. So, it basically washes out there.
Well, it's debatable what actually happens in this movie itself, because the title is Through the Portal of Time, but the characters in the movie describe L.A. as being an alternate dimension. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you can check your history books for anything resembling Archlon and Lyrana and the Beastmaster, and I don't think it really shows up.
Well, you know, maybe it's a time lost to history, right? Plenty of people today also describe L.A. as an alternate dimension as well, so I don't know.
I guess so. So we were talking, I don't know exactly where this subgenre comes from, but it might all be traceable back to the 1987 He-Man movie, Masters of the Universe, in which Dolph Lundgren plays He-Man. He ends up transported to modern day L.A. for some reason in his quest to defeat the evil Skeletor, played by Frank Langella.
Yeah, that was a fun flick. I remember seeing that in the theater. Some older kids took me, some like friends of the family, and it felt very grown up in many ways. It was a lot of this kind of dark stuff in there. They really took the world of these action figures and the cartoon, and they played it downright serious at times. Especially towards the beginning and towards the end, because you have all this like cool stuff where Skeletor looks amazing, and he has this I would say the sweetest band of underlings and hench creatures this side of Empire Strikes Back.
It's got Meg Foster as some kind of evil sorceress. I think it's got Billy Barty.
Yeah, Billy Barty's in there. You're playing a magical creature. You've got a lizard man. You've got a beast man. You've got some sort of a big-haired, gnarly dwarf. You have a sword guy. And then, of course, you have the sword guy, Dolph Lundgren, playing He-Man in a costume designed by Mobius. I mean, what more do you need? But I do remember, of course, the thing about Masters of the Universe, you have that whole central section where they're dumped into our world.
Yeah.
And even at the time, I was like, oh, man, I kind of wish we could have stayed in Eternia. Like, that's where these characters should be. Why are they invading my world? But I, you know, you roll with it because eventually you get back to Eternia.
You got to make it relevant. But these weren't the only two movies. Amazingly, you dug up at least one other movie where there's like a sword swinging meat man who ends up transported to modern day LA. Was that Time Barbarians from 1991?
Yes, I have not seen Time Barbarians, and I suspect a lot of people have not seen Time Barbarians, but it is a film that definitely exists and does not feature anyone I'm really familiar with. Mm. But it's time. It's basically the same plot as what we're talking about here. Some sort of a barbarian dude chases a bad guy to modern day LA. So it's very much in keeping with what we're talking about here.
Though, you know, a funny thing is that I just realized the third live-action Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie is basically the inverse of this plot. So it takes, like, rad, pizza-eating modern L.A. Heroes in turtle form and transports them back to, like, feudal Japan.
Yeah, the reverse of this you see with there's some military applications of this, right? There's at least one noteworthy American film and a Japanese film where you have like modern day combat units traveling back in time and then potentially changing world events. Speaking of such, there's a Hong Kong film, and I think this one's a very vague memory. It took me a while to find this film, but I believe The Iceman Cometh from 1989. This is about Ming Dynasty warriors who get frozen and then wake up in modern times and have to battle each other with swords. This is often compared to Highlander and seems to have maybe been inspired by Highlander. And I guess we have to consider the possibility that the Highlander DNA is on all of this as well, even though the characters in Highlander, the immortals, are traveling through time the slow way. There's still a little bit of fish out of water stuff. Like the Kurgan never really adapts. And one of the characters in our film today is very much in Kurgan mode.
Oh yeah, Archlon, played by Wings Hauser in Beastmaster 2, has strong notes of Kurgan.
Yeah, I would say, I guess I'm not giving Kurgan a fair shake. Kurgan does adapt to modern times, but he only adapts to like the violent subcultures of modern times.
He becomes like a punk body modification biker. But I think it's also interesting how many parallels you would find in movies of this kind, because I feel like they've all got to have some similar elements, like your meat beast discovers rock and roll or some other pop music genre. They get into a dance club, or they learn about rap music or something. And it's like, wow, this music is like nothing I've ever heard. It frightens me. And then you have a scene where the meat beast discovers pizza or chocolate or some other food of the gods. You have the meat beast marveling at the magic box that shows pictures. You have the meat beast terrified by traffic, cars, freeways. And then finally, I think you've always got to have a scene where your meat beast has an encounter with the local police, and they're all like, oh, it's another one of these weirdos.
Yeah.
If there are any amateur film historians out there, though, that know where all of this subgenre traces back to, is it Masters, or is it something else? I don't know.
At any rate, it is a winning formula.
Even if it doesn't always make for great movies, it does make movies that win.
I wonder what it does say about the sort of nature of the muscly hero. And this might be something that is explored in some of the serious literature out there. I was reading some of this regarding Hercules, but the first Beastmaster film, your lead character, the Beastmaster himself, is it's played pretty seriously. In this movie, he's mostly a doofus.
Yeah.
So I wonder, there's probably something deeper going on there about our relationship to these like hyper masculine images.
Oh, I just thought of another variation. This is not exactly the same formula, but it's kind of close. Arnold Schwarzenegger's first movie, Hercules in New York.
Oh yeah, and to a limited degree, you can compare this to Terminator as well. I mean, he's coming from the future. And he's maybe more finely tuned to fit in. He knows exactly what he's going to do. He's not going to marvel at the rock and roll and the pizza too much. But occasionally, he gets something wrong, like asking for a plasma rifle at the gun store.
Oh, yeah, phased plasma rifle. Only what you see, pal. That's Dick Miller.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, here we would usually give the elevator pitch, but I think we've already given it, right? It's Beastmaster. It's L.A. What else do you need?
Yeah, Beastmaster in L.A. That's it.
Beastmaster learns Valley speak. Beastmaster learns how to party, you know. So I guess we should hear some trailer audio.
All right, let's do it.
Come through the doorway to another dimension.
Whoa!
With the Beastmaster and the creatures he commands.
Hey, rad!
From their world to ours. It's the wildest adventure that time has ever known. Beastmaster 2, Through the Portal of Time.
Rock and roll, baby.
Rated PG-13. Coming August 30th to a theater near you.
All right. So you're probably wondering, well, who are the fine people who brought this vision to the screen? Let's talk about the people of note here. First of all, the director and also one of the many writers credited on this screenplay is Silvio Tabet, a Lebanese producer known for his involvement in such 80s films as Dead Ringers, The Cotton Club, Evil Speak, Fade to Black, and of course, The Beastmaster, the first film. He was also associate producer on Alejandro Jodorowsky's 1980 film Tusk. This is the possibly lost film about an elephant. And, of course, he's noted for this movie as well. This is his only time he directed or did any screenwriting. He's mostly a producer. And from here, he'd go on to produce Beastmaster 3 in 1996 and the 66-episode cable TV show The Beastmaster from 1999 through 2000.
Now, I don't want to do too much surmising because I don't know what went on behind the scenes here, but I do wonder if this is one of those classic cases of somebody is involved in the film industry and to the extent of putting up the money for films, being the lead investor or the producer in that sense. And then they're like, okay, I get how this business works. I can be the creative director behind a movie.
Yeah, I think there was something like that. I'm going to go and skip to the two main screenplay credits on this, because the first is Jim Wynarski, who has a story and screenplay credit. This is, of course, Jim Wynarski from 1986 film Chopping Mall, which we've discussed on the show before. Also notable for Swamp Thing 2 and various other films. And then the other story screenplay credit goes to R.J. Robertson, who lived 1946 through 1994, worked in the animation department on Chopping Mall and did visual effects on Buckaroo Banzai, Dreamscape, and Troll, and also wrote Deathstalker 2 and a few other titles. But it seems to be the case where I believe Jim Wynorski was going to direct this thing and then lost control of the picture. And I didn't dig too deep into this, but I think there was some bad blood here. I usually don't follow all those threads myself because I don't want to sour my appreciation of the film. You know, I want it to be this fun experience, and I don't want to know too much about any kind of beef going on behind the scenes.
Well, the claim I read, and this was only hearing Wynorski's side, so I can't vouch for this being true, but what he claimed is that he, like, worked on the script with the understanding that he would get to direct it. And then at the last minute, Tabbitt was like, oh, no, actually, I'm going to direct it. And then so they got into some big legal brouhaha about that. And Wynorski apparently was able to extract some major money or concessions or something out of them in order to let them proceed.
So at any rate, if you're familiar with Jim Wynorski's filmography, I feel like you can identify some of the touches in the screenplay. I feel like a lot of this picture feels very much in keeping with some of the things I've seen from him, especially Swamp Thing 2. I can easily compare this film to Swamp Thing 2.
Well, I was going to say that the satirical elements of this script are way below the mark of Chopping Mall. Like, I feel like Chopping Mall is pretty sharp, pretty funny, as written. And this one, it has actors in it that can elevate it above the level of the script, but the script itself is pretty dreadful.
It is it's interesting because it's kind of a self-riffing movie.
Yes.
There are characters in place whose role is to riff on things. And most of the characters come off as doofuses throughout. It's hard to think of anyone who doesn't come off as a doofus in this movie. But that's ultimately the thing I enjoyed the most about it.
Yeah, I thought the exact same thing. There is at least one major character who, I'd say multiple major characters who riff on the film as it goes. One of them really works and the other really doesn't. But we'll come back to that. But this actually, so the script is not very closely based on, but partially based on a novel by Andre Norton, right?
Right. Andre Norton, who lived 1912 through 2005, born Alice Mary Norton, but she published under the pen name Andre Norton. I'm not super familiar with her. I don't know that I've read any of her work before, but she was a pulp era genre writer and was seemingly quite prolific. In 1959, she wrote a book called Beastmaster about a Navajo former soldier with telepathic links to genetically altered animals that ends up having adventures on other planets. Obviously, very little of that was adapted into the Beastmaster film from Don Coscarelli and Paul Pepperman. They wrote the screenplay for the original. But these are apparently, there are like five different Beastmaster books from Norton. Again, I haven't read them. If anyone out there has read them, I'd be curious to hear your take on all of this.
Well, you know, I also don't know a lot about Andre Norton, but I know that some of her works, like I think her Witch World series, involved blending science fiction and like magic, fantasy, sword and sorcery kind of stuff together in the same universe. Mm-hmm. And I would say Beastmaster 2 does that.
Yeah, in that sense, I guess Beastmaster 2 is more in keeping with the sort of fiction she created. And I'll briefly point out that there's also someone named Doug Miles who has a screenplay credit on this, but I couldn't find out anything about them. I think this is their only credit on anything. But just for the sake of having another human being involved in the creation of this strange film.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
All right, let's move on to the cast. We got to start at the top. Who do we have playing the Beastmaster? A man named Dar. It is Mark Singer, born 1948.
What do I think of this performance? I would say that Mark Singer shifts pretty effortlessly between the characters' two modes in this movie, and they are very different modes. One of them is standard barbarian fantasy action hero, and the other is a befuddled weirdo wandering around mostly naked on the sidewalk.
Yeah. I don't remember enough about his performance in Beastmaster, though, I've seen it so many times, to really comment too much on this. Like, I wonder how much of the weirdness is just taking that character out of a fantasy setting and placing him in New York. Because, he often just comes off as this kind of, like, weird dude with ferrets. Weird, lean, muscular, 40-year-old with oiled skin. It's kind of an interesting balancing act, because they'll have these scenes where he is at once very awkward in that he is, a fish out of water. He's in downtown L.A. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, he is also perfectly at ease standing there on the street, mostly naked. We're just wearing this leather loincloth thing.
So, like, somebody turns on the stereo and it plays hair metal at him, and he's like befuddled and freaked out. Oh, what is this? It frightens and confuses me.
Yes.
But then in other scenes, he's wandering through this now house of the 1990s, and he, like, easily begins conversing and comforting someone about the death of a parent.
Yeah.
And it's just like this, I don't know. Sometimes he's incredibly socially competent, and other times he's out of his depth.
Yeah. So it's a weird performance to watch. He mostly comes off as a doofus in this when he's not actually, like, fighting. And even then, I don't know, an argument can be made. Now, Mark Singer is probably best remembered for Beastmaster 1 and, yes, Beastmaster 2, along with the 80s V movie and the TV show that followed. Though we shouldn't forget that there also is a Beastmaster 3, And Mark Singer is in that alongside Tony Todd, Casper Van Dien, and David Warner.
What?
Yeah.
Two great actors and a Casper.
Yeah. So Mark Singer has worked a lot over the years, and I believe he's still active. Stuff that stands out to me in his filmography includes voicing the Man-Bat on Batman the Animated Series.
Oh, wow.
And he's
that was a good episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I enjoyed those episodes. There's also the 1997 film Lancelot, Guardian of Time. He's the hero opposite John Saxon in that. Listeners, like hardcore listeners to the show, might remember that we heard from another listener who worked on this film and was almost killed by John Saxon during one of the stunts.
That might be a slight exaggeration, but yes, like a sword came in their direction, right?
Yes, but everybody was okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, Mark is he's in great shape in this. We've got to give him that. And I feel like he does everything that is asked of him in this of this film. I feel like that's something I can say for most of the cast. Did they perform what they could with what they were given? Did they even excel in their roles given what they were given? I would say yes.
Okay, I guess from here we should move on to talking about, I would argue, our two characters in the movie who both function simultaneously as actors within the plot and sort of characters on the satellite of love riffing the movie as it goes, except they're mm-hmm. in it. And those would be Carrie Werwer playing Jackie Trent and Sarah Douglas playing Lirana. Which do you want to talk about first?
Let's talk about Carrie Werwer.
Okay.
Again, plays Jackie Trent, who is our party girl who ends up sucked into the plot of this movie. So Werwer was born in 1967. This was only her third film role, following Fire with Fire and The Adventures of Ford Fairlane. But she went on to be in a whole string of interesting things. She played Abigail Arcane on the Swamp Thing TV show for 10 episodes in the early 90s. She went on to act in 1996's Thinner, and she was in 1997's Anaconda.
Oh boy, she is an anaconda. I think she gets eaten by an anaconda.
I would hope so. I mean, if you're in Anaconda and you don't get et by a snake, what are you doing?
No, wait a minute. Now that I think about it, actually, she maybe gets murdered by John Voight.
Well, that's good enough.
Yeah, that's a similar fate.
Yeah. So she worked regularly after that with runs on Sliders and General Hospital, but she was also in Hellraiser Deader from 2005.
Mm. Ugh.
And she was in two, not one, but two prophecy films the same year, Uprising and Forsaken. I'm sad to say neither of those had Christopher Walken in them at all.
Mm-hmm.
And she's mostly done a lot of voiceover work for animated projects recently.
So I got to be honest and evaluate the performance. I don't think it's entirely Carrie Werwer's fault. I think a lot of it is in the lines given to her and how she was clearly instructed to perform this character. But I would say her character, Jackie Trent, is intensely annoying in this movie. There were groans aplenty in our house as the movie was being screened.
Yeah. I certainly groaned some watching it by myself, but on the other hand, I don't know if I'd want a real strong performance here. You know, like like there are scenes where she's threatened by our main villain, but you never really buy that she's in danger. Like those scenes don't feel very terrifying, in part because of her performance. And I don't know that I would want that scene to be terrifying.
No, she's sort of flippantly riffing and reviewing the movie as it goes on. So she doesn't ever feel very in the plot, which is good. I mean, that works for how silly this movie is. But I would say there's another character who sort of does that, but does it so well that this character kind of fades back. So the other one is Sarah Douglas playing the character Lirana, a sorceress. And I would say this is the breakout character of the movie. Sarah Douglas is by far the best actor in the film, and she makes her character a lot of fun despite the dreadfully cringy writing. I would say this is a classic example of a great actor really elevating their role above what it would be just on paper.
Oh, yeah. She's really good. Sarah Douglas was born in 1952, probably best known for playing General Zod's underling Ursa in Superman 1 and 2. But she was also in Conan the Destroyer. She played the evil queen in that. She's still active today, mostly in voice work, but she's been in a ton of weird stuff over the years. She played Dracula's wife opposite Jack Palance in 1974's Dracula.
I want to see that now.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, but I don't remember Dracula's wife from the book.
I mean, of course I love her in the Superman movies, but I guess there's so much going on in those. She stood out less. In a bad movie like this, she really just like beams like the sun. So now I want to see all of Sarah Douglas's movies. I've got to see her as Dracula's wife.
She is, of course, also in Jim Warnarski's The Return of the Swamp Thing from 1989. She pops up in Puppet Master 3, Meatballs 4, Return of the Living Dead 3, and also 1993's Quest of the Delta Knights, which, of course, famously stars David Warner in two different roles. Uh-huh. So I would say her legacy is assured.
We're not worthy.
All right. She's an interesting character because she's also not a pure villain. She's kind of a tweener, right? She's in it for herself. She's having to work twice as hard as these other characters to achieve what she needs to get. Our main, like, just pure villain that's played very straight. It also comes off as a doofus plenty of times, but this character is never quite winking at the camera. This is the character Arklon, played by Wings Hauser.
I'd say this is another standout performance in the film. Our villain duo are clearly the highlight for me. Sarah Douglas is that ray of sunshine, and Arklon is just the glowing pits of hell.
Yes. Oh, Wings Hauser. There is so much Wings Hauser in this film. And it's probably not surprising that he has a screenwriting credit as well. So maybe those two are connected.
Yeah.
Because he's probably like, I like this, but I think this film needs more Arklon. I'll have some pages for you.
Well, yeah, you know, this movie does something very well. And despite all of our criticisms and being honest and having to say, you know, a lot of things about the script are not so good. It has villains in a silly movie where the actors fully commit to going over the top. Like, they're not trying to be cool. They're not trying to say, oh, I don't want to look too silly. They're just going for it. And that works.
Yeah, and Wings Hauser goes for it in this. So this is the son of Hollywood Disney director Dwight Hauser, the father of actor Cole Hauser. Have anyone seen a Cole Hauser movie? I think he shows up in the Fast and the Furious movies at some point.
Maybe that's right.
Wings, if you're wondering, was a nickname he earned in high school sports. This apparently is referring to the wingback position in football. I'm not sure what that means, but that's where it comes from. And he was also a musician for a spell under the name Wings Livin' Right, putting out the 1975 album Your Love Keeps Me Off the Streets, which has a wonderfully dorky album cover. And I don't know, Your Love Keeps Me Off the Street, that doesn't sound like a healthy relationship. I feel like there's some imbalance going on here.
You could make a poster for Beastmaster 2 that's Mark Singer saying that to his ferrets.
Yeah. So Wings Hauser is notable for, he's been in a lot of things over the years. He played the violent pimp Ramrod in Gary Sherman's Vice Squad from 1982, a film that he also sang the theme song for, Neon Slime. He's had notable roles in such films as Tough Guys Don't Dance. He pops up in The Insider, I think playing a big tobacco lawyer. He's also in Tales from the Hood, Watchers 3, Mutant, and a movie called The Wind. Mutant has been featured on Riff Tracks before, and The Wind has been on my radar for a while. That's one that looks kind of interesting.
Mm.
Wings Hauser has a distinctive screen presence that I was working hard trying to figure out how to describe, because
Wait a minute. It seems like you nailed it in your very first comment to me. You texted me just the phrase toothy egg. Yes. I was like, yep.
Yeah, toothy egg. I think that does encapsulate it. But he's like, it's easy to think, okay, there's a little bit of Gary Busey to him, you know, like maybe he's like a discount Gary Busey, but it's more than that. He's great at portraying this kind of unhinged turbo jock. You know, he has that kind of physicality. Uh-huh. But he also has, yeah, this largish head and a smile that's just a full upper dental exam. Like, when he smiles, you can see all of his upper teeth. And it makes for just a wonderfully sadistic smile. I think if he had ever actually shaved his head, first of all, he would have looked like a toothy egg. But he would have looked a lot like drawings I've seen, interpretations of the character Judge Holden from Blood Meridian.
Yep. He's also a big guy, which helps. Tall.
Yeah. I looked up his height. I was like, how big is this guy? And I think he's only 6'2", but.
Oh, okay.
But in movies, you know, a lot of times you're working on opposite actors that are really not that tall in stature. Mm-hmm. So you can still tower over somebody.
Oh, he seemed bigger to me.
Yeah. Not like what Vince Vaughn is really tall. Like it probably, like they have to use special effects to get Vince Vaughn.
I've never measured him.
I've just read that he's like 6'8", 6'10", something like that. I don't know. I think he's still growing. He's like a reptile.
Vince Vaughn's as tall as Michael Jordan.
One more thing about Wings Hauser here is, yes, he has a screenwriting credit on Beastmaster 2. And he also, this wasn't his only time he contributed to a screenplay. He also contributed to the screenplays of Uncommon Valor, No Safe Haven, and Skins from 1994, which he also directed.
I've never seen any of the Wings Hauser movies.
I think you're fine skipping them. But he's pretty tremendous in this. All right, we have a few other players in smaller roles that I think are worth mentioning. We have a couple of cops that show up, because you got to have cops on the scene to sort of be bewildered by all this barbarian magic that's going on in modern day LA.
Yeah.
And they're both pretty fun, but the main cop character is Lieutenant Cobberly, played by the always fun James Avery
from Fresh Prince.
Yeah, yeah, he played. The patriarch of the family, Philip Banks. But more than that, he also voiced Shredder on the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles animated series.
Yeah, he did a lot of voice acting. Mm-hmm. I was looking at his credits and I was like, wow.
Yeah, especially some of the shows from back in the day. Yeah, he popped up on a lot of those. He got to play a Klingon on Star Trek Enterprise, but it did a tremendous amount of TV work going back to 1980, I believe. He lived 1945 through 2013.
In this movie, he plays a weary, exasperated police commander who it's like he's so tired of dealing with like barbarians who show up through dimensional rifts.
Yeah.
You know, this is like the eighth one this week, and it's just really wearing on him.
Yeah. All right. Now, we get into a couple of very small roles here, but they're worth mentioning because Robert Zadar shows up in this.
I don't think he has any lines, but he's you notice him in the background there.
Yeah, yeah, he may yell something. I'm not sure, but
get
it. That's the extent of it. He plays his character has a name, Zavik. Robert Zadar lived 1950 through 2015. Low budget B movie legend. This man, he's the man with $1 million chin. It's kind of shocking that it took this long for us to cover a film that has Robert Zadar in it. He's probably best known to horror fans as the original Maniac Cop. MST3K fans will know him best from Soul Taker and Future War. And mainstream fans might remember him from playing, I think he plays like a criminal or some sort of a heavy in Tango and Cash. But he was in all sorts of low-budget movies, including the excellent Samurai Cop. He's the main antagonist in that. Mm-hmm. He also has a role in Cherry 2000, which is a lot of fun. A memorable character actor, in part due to his cherubism, which was a medical condition that resulted in that enlarged jawline that he has. Sometimes more pronounced in certain roles and certain times in his life than others. But he was certainly one of a kind. When Zadar shows up on screen, you know what you're dealing with.
Yeah, if he's in the fight, you know the hero will not win unless it's in the last 5 minutes of the movie.
Now, another character actor with a very distinctive look that pops up towards the end in a role that we'll describe later on. Michael Berryman appears in the film. Michael Berryman was born 1948. He was born with hypohidrotic ectodermal dysplasia, a rare condition characterized by the absence of sweat glands, hair, and fingernails. He has over 100 screen credits, including memorable roles, of course, in Wes Craven's The Hills Have Eyes from 1977, another memorable role in Weird Science from 1985. He's in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He pops up in Star Trek The Voyage Home, The Barbarians from 1987, and so much more. He has a really fun role in an episode of Tales from the Crypt, playing a creepy vampire hunter opposite the very likable vampire played by Malcolm McDowell.
Oh, I haven't seen that one. Maybe I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, The Reluctant Vampire is the name of it. It's pretty fun.
Well, it's interesting that they Berryman barely has a role in this movie. It's just a cameo. So it almost seems like they were just trying to pull in recognizable people from other genre movies just to, you know, for a day or something to say, hey, will you be in the scene?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because someone like Berryman is certainly legendary now. And even at the time, I think when they were putting this together, it's like, oh, we should get Berryman. Yeah, let's bring him in. And really, with our next cast member to mention, again, this is a bit part, playing scientist number one is Dick Warlock.
I didn't even notice him.
Yeah, I noticed him only because I knew to look for him. But this is, of course, the stuntman and actor best known for his work on various John Carpenter projects, including turns as Michael Myers and, of course, a killer android in Halloween 3 Season of the Witch.
Tom Atkins, like, punches him in the stomach and a bunch of orange juice comes out.
Yeah. I think Dick Warlock does have a line in this. I think he's the scientist who yells something when our villain steals something from him. And then finally, Frank Welker, the legendary voice actor, born 1946, is credited with several roles. I believe these are all animals. So anytime you hear an animal screeching or growling or whatever in this film, it's probably Frank Welker in a sound booth somewhere. And that's exactly what you should think about when those sounds occur.
Wow. Well, I got to say, one of the most hilarious recurring things in this movie is when Mark Singer himself would screech like an eagle to get his eagle's attention. Every time it happened, it was a fresh delight.
Finally, I'll say that the music for this film, while nothing that really stands out to me, but also something, the weird thing is this was a soundtrack that was released on CD. So many, we've touched on far more interesting scores that never had any kind of release, but this one was released. It's from Robert Folk. Born 1949, TV and film composer who worked on Ace Ventura 2, The NeverEnding Story 2, Van Wilder 2, Boy's Life 2, Lawnmower Man 2, and Police Academy 2. Though to be fair, he did like seven Police Academy movies. So he also scored the 1982 J.S. Cardone movie, The Slayer, which I've mentioned on the show before because it takes place on George's own Tybee Island.
It seems like that comes up every episode now.
What? I know. I'm going to have to break down and watch it again.
Okay.
But only, I should only watch it if I go back to Tybee Island. It's really, it's best experienced if you have some connection to the place where it's filmed.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
So I guess if it's time to talk about the plot, Rob, I'm going to say before we get to anything else, I don't know if you noticed the same thing, but for most of the runtime of this movie, it does not have enough colors in it. There are long stretches where basically everything on screen is some shade of orange. And then finally they go to LA and then there are a bunch of colors and it's great. But like the scenes that take place in the fantasy realm are just like orange on orange on orange. And it really starts to wear on the eyes.
Yeah. I mean, it is a desert wasteland world. So I guess some of that makes sense.
But okay, so to address the beginning, the film opens on a setting sun, on a horizon of sand dunes, everything's orange, and we see a text crawl in orange text saying, "In the days following the death of King Zed, a darkness has fallen over the land of Arrak." Oh, I forgot the land had a name. I've just been calling it like Desert World or Beastmaster World. Okay, it's Arrak. It says, "The evil warlord Arklon, using unholy magic, has enslaved the people. Their only hope rests with the rebel forces marshaling in the east under the leadership of Dar, the Beastmaster."
I have to say that this movie hilariously, at times, puts in a little extra work to connect itself to the story of Beastmaster 1. When really it was totally unnecessary. I mean, this is a movie in which at one point in LA, the Beastmaster is riding past a movie theater, and the movie theater on the marquee, it says Beastmaster 2 through the portal of time. And he comments on it. Like this is the level of movie this is. You really don't have to work too hard to stitch it into the plot of the previous installment.
Also, doesn't it retcon, like, doesn't it take characters that were killed in the first Beastmaster movie and just they're alive again?
Like maybe some of the animals, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. At least that's what I read.
Yeah, so it's weird that at times they're throwing in extra lines to sort of connect things. And like, does it really matter that the villain and the Beastmaster are brothers? I don't know. It just gives them something to talk about while swinging swords, I guess.
Did you notice that the title, when it pops up, it says Beastmaster 2 through the Portal of Time. It looks like a title that would be printed on the side of an arcade cabinet. Like, it looks like it should say insert coins below it.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't think about that when I saw it, but now, yeah, absolutely.
Like, you just washed out on Golden Axe or on the Neo Geo machine, and you're like, oh, let's give Beastmaster 2 through the Portal of Time a try. All right, but the opening is you have a bunch of evil, faceless warriors in leather armor, and they're bringing a captive into some underground lair. So we have a cave, it's very orange, lit by firelight, orange rocks, and the guards take the hood off the captive, and it is our hero, Dar. You remember him from the previous Beastmaster movie. And how to describe Dar, the Beastmaster? I would say he is a baby-oiled muscle guy in a loincloth wearing a leather strap around his forehead. So it's under the hair, just going around the head, and a cascade of blonde hair flowing over each ear.
Yeah, surfer dude physique, surfer dude hair.
And so these soldiers are bringing Dar before some kind of council of creeps. I didn't know who these dudes were, but they're these like guys in hoods. It kind of looks like he has to face the judgment of three brain guys from Mystery Science Theater. Yeah. And they sit there and they scowl at him. And we get our Arklon reveal because Wingshauser walks out and sneers mightily. Oh, and also we get a brief glimpse of Robert Zadar here. He's one of the soldiers in the background, and he's wearing a hat that looks like an upside-down boat.
Yes.
Oh, and I forgot how quickly they introduce all the characters here, because the lead creep of the Council of Brain Guys pushes Dar's sword and satchel off the table in disgust, and immediately we get a ferret reveal, because the bag falls to the ground and then two ferrets squeak and crawl out of the bag. These are Kodo and Podo, our loyal ferret friends for the rest of the film.
Yes. They don't necessarily do a lot in this film versus the first film, but still, they're cute when they're on screen, and makes for some weird scenes with the brandishing of ferrets.
Yes. No. They're good. I like the ferrets. You're right. They don't do much. They do a bit at the beginning, though. Yeah. So the brain guy renders the verdict. He says the man named Dar has been found guilty of complicity with the rebels to overthrow the holy power of Lord Arklon. So, anti-Arklon activities. That sounds very serious. And he says, the accused has also demonstrated a knowledge of witchcraft and his ability to control the beasts of the field. So, sentence is death.
What hypocrisy.
I know. But so, Arklon, by the way, won't just take the win and have his enemy beheaded. He has to gloat for a while. And he does a gesture at Dar. Is he doing the fig gesture? It kind of looks like it, but maybe he's just making a weird fist.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I couldn't really make it out.
I feel like it would be a strange choice to have the villain of the movie just do the fig into the camera.
I mean, he might have just been gesticulating just so hard, you know, because again, Wings Hauser just pours it all into this role, just constantly snarling and seething or gloating. There's no subtlety to this character.
And he tries to, I think, tie it into the events of the first movie, because Wings Hauser is like, so this is the Beastmaster who killed our priest Mayox and now challenges my authority. But was that Rip Torn in the first movie?
I believe that was Rip Torn's character. I could be wrong on that. But yeah, Rip Torn played a marvel. Also, you know, totally overacting and chewing up the scene, but in a suitably Rip Torn way. He was like the high priest. Loved to sacrifice children.
Well, anyway, so one of the brain guys says, in the name of Lord Arklon, I hereby condemn you to eternal damnation. And I was like, what? He can do that? Wow.
Well, he can say it anyway.
So Dar just stares at everybody in the scene. He doesn't talk. And they take him up to some kind of altar where they're going to decapitate him. They bring up the Jack Ketch of Arklonia. And just before the axe falls, Dar is rescued by his loyal beast buddies. So his tiger, Rue, attacks the guards. And then he's got two ferrets, Kodo and Podo. They're the ones that crawled out of the bag earlier. They gnaw the ropes off of his wrists. And he's got a pet eagle named Shirok who flies around squawking at things. And there's a big fight scene. Eventually it comes down to Dar and Arklon. And Arklon has a secret weapon that he uses throughout the entire movie. So maybe we should know the name of it. Is this, Rob, is this the Key of Magog? I think they only say the name of it once.
Yes, this is the Key of Magog. It's pretty cool. It's like, it's not your typical wand. It has like a laser emitter on both ends, and then they shoot lasers together, which can join into a single beam. He seems to have, there's different settings. Like sometimes he seems to have it set to stun. Other times he has it set to open giant flaming crack in the earth.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure exactly how the interface works here.
He can summon winds out of it. Sometimes he shoots a laser, but it's not a laser. It like creates a storm.
Yeah.
But when faced with this laser weapon, Dar pulls out his secret weapon, which is going, squawking like a bird at his eagle. This hilarious activity that he repeats many times in the film. And then the eagle flies in and just gashes up Arklon's face really good. Just claws out, destroying Arklon's beautiful visage. And every scene after this, Arklon wears a Phantom of the Opera mask.
Yes.
But Dar and his animal buddies escape. They get out of the stone fortress, ride off into the desert, pursued by Arklon's guards. And in the next scene, we meet the rebels that Arklon is so worried about. And once you see them, I don't know if it seems like he should be all that concerned. These guys do not appear to have it together. They are like a gaggle of confused men wandering around in the desert, awkwardly holding plastic swords.
Yeah.
But they do have one ace in the hole, which is custody of, quote, the witch, who is the sorceress Lyrana. And this is our introduction to Sarah Douglas. Again, I think the best actor in the movie by a mile. When we were watching this, Rachel said, wow, she really puts the wit in witch. And I think that sums it up pretty well. She is, as we were saying, operating on a plane of reality above the rest of the movie. It's like she is riffing the movie, but also a character within it. So she's all weird jokes, saucy innuendo, and Austin Powers level one-liners. Like Seconds after her introduction, a rebel leader is skewered through the neck with an arrow, and she's like, I guess he got the point.
The first of many great one-liners from her. And she has some that she keeps busting out just because they're so good. She keeps punching up her material.
Yeah, she's like Roger Moore as James Bond as a sorceress.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the idea, at first I wasn't sure if she was from our world, if she is from L.A., but it seems like that's not the case. She's either visited it before or she's watched it through the time gate enough that she's hip to a little bit of what this other world is about, and she's picked up some of the lingo.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think she is a sorceress from the fantasy world. She's from A-Rock or wherever this is, but she has been to L.A. many times, I believe, or at least watched it, because she already knows how to do Valley speak.
Oh, God, yes.
But anyway, Lyrana tricks the rebels into being ambushed by Arklon because that's her ultimate game plan. She wants to join forces with Arklon anyway. And we find out later that her plan all along was to kill him and then take over the kingdom for herself. But at this point, she's just sort of like going along with him, I think, to make use of his army.
Right. And to manipulate him as best she can.
Now, like, one thing Wingshauser decides to do with the Arklon character is he starts cackling every time he shoots his magic laser. Like, it's real funny to him.
Yes. Yeah, there's never a dull moment with Arklon. He's just always letting loose.
The battle scene here has some really funny fake boulders. Like, he uses the laser to make the boulders roll, and they're almost perfectly spherical.
Yeah, there's some boulders falling. It's pretty great.
Yeah, but Arklon wins, and then Lyrana, the witch, she makes her appeal. She says, well, yes, you have the power of the Key of Magog, that's his laser wand, but you can't win this conflict without my help. And this is the scene where she not only makes the strategic appeal to Arklon, she starts using this excruciating Valley speak. At one point she says, chill out, Lord Dude.
I love it. Perhaps the greatest line in the whole picture.
Yeah. And he's all like, what is this strange tongue in which you speak?
Yeah. And he keeps at first he tells his guards, it's like, have her drawn and quartered. And then he like kind of tries to fake her out. And he's like, burn her alive. And I kind of felt bad for the guards here. It's like, oh, my goodness. Like, both of those things take a lot of work. Like, mm-hmm. This guy is such a fuss. He can't just order somebody murdered on the spot. No, it's got to be a huge production that's going to just take up time and resources. It's a wonder he gets anything done.
Yeah. But anyway, her pitch is that, well, he may be the most powerful man in the world, but only she can provide him with the power to make himself a god. And I think she knows how to appeal to Arklon. He is intrigued. So he, mm-hmm. He lets her live for the moment, and they're going to set up an alliance. And meanwhile, we go back to Dar, and this is onto the swamp sequence, a very weird scene that feels visually at least out of place with the rest of the movie. But here's the basic rundown. Okay, so Arklon's guards still chasing Dar. They chase him into the swamp. Then they are mauled by some kind of horrible bog critter with glowing eyes that looks sort of like a cross between Swamp Thing and Augra from The Dark Crystal.
Mm-hmm.
Then Swamp Critter attacks Dar, but then stops. And then it starts to talk and it gives him a whole speech, the gist of which is, I am your aunt. I was turned into a swamp critter because I did unholy rituals. Arklon is your brother and you have to defeat him or it will be the end of the world.
I believe that Jim Wynarski has commented that the original script, or somebody, I read somewhere that the original script was more based in the fantasy world and less in ours, if not exclusively in the fantasy world. I'm not sure. But like, this is definitely a scene where that feels like an artifact of an earlier draft.
Yes.
That maybe was more connected with things in an earlier draft of the script.
I love that it's his aunt, though. What a choice.
Yeah.
And he's totally surprised. He's like, I didn't even know I had an aunt, much less that she was a swamp critter.
Yeah.
Anyway, next scene, we finally get the Portal of Time reveal. Rob, can you describe the scene? This is the scene where Lyrana shows off the portal to L.A., to Arklon. And Arklon, as he does many times in the movie, can't pronounce the words she's telling him from our world correctly. Mm-hmm. So she's like, the natives call it L.A., and he's like, Al-A.
Yeah, And at first, he's not sure that this is an actual portal. He thinks it's an illusion, but he's very impressed. And she quickly impresses upon him that, like, this is the place where you can really make your future, because it's LA, right? This is a place that draws many people who are dreaming of reaching that next level of success. You know, some people want to get into the movies. Some people want to, you know, rule the world. And that's where Arklon comes in here.
Well, yeah, she gets him all riled up about something called a neutron detonator, which is some kind of device that, if detonated, will destroy the entire world. And she's like, they have it in this world, but you can steal it and bring it back to our world, and then you will rule with no challenge.
Now, I mean, luckily, she is just manipulating him here, so we can sort of, you know, dismiss a lot of the ridiculousness of this. She's just saying, there's something so powerful can destroy a world here. Don't you want that? And he's like, yes, of course. That sounds awesome. Though, of course, in reality, like, I was thinking about this a little bit. It's like, okay, let's assume this is essentially a nuclear weapon. If Arklon brings a nuclear weapon back to his barbarian fantasy world, like, the applications there are pretty limited. You've got to have a very specific use of said weapon in order to really do anything in the world that that benefits yourself. Like, I was trying to think, well, what could he do? Like, yeah, I guess you could smuggle it into, like, a rival kingdom and set it off. I think at one point in R. Scott Baker's fantasy series, there's a use of an atomic weapon in a fantasy setting that ultimately makes sense. That seems like the kind of thing you could do if you could, you know, position it in a place where an advancing army might run into it. But otherwise, yeah, what's this going to do for him? And he doesn't really understand it either, though it is neat that when he first sees a car, he's like, oh, these would really help us. And that ultimately makes more sense. Like, you can imagine if he just had a fleet of trucks, that is something that could make a strategic difference in the world that he comes from.
Yeah, that is what he should want, is cars. And in fact, yeah, he does see it. He goes, what an incredible machine. With this, I could rule the world. And Sarah Douglas is like, it's called a car. And he says, a dar? No, a car. A car.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Oh, but also at the time they're looking at this portal, we get a peek at the other side, and we meet our main character from the real world, played by Kerry Warrer. This is Jackie Trent, daughter of a certain Senator Trent, which I think is also the name of a bad guy from one of those other bad 80s action movies, Hard to Kill or something.
Hmm.
Anyway, Jackie is a 20-something Californian who likes to party and who enjoys reckless driving. And in the first scene, she is driving recklessly while speaking to her father on a mobile telephone. The police are in hot pursuit. She's trying to outrun them while she is listening to Knock Off Kenny Loggins. It is, it felt very on the nose for me. It was like, you know, it was like, I am all good. Nobody be concerned about me.
Yeah, I don't think they licensed, I could be wrong on this, but I don't think they licensed any music for this. I think all the rock songs and hip songs that we hear in this are composed by Robert Folk.
Okay, that would make sense. They're original for the movie. I mean, this just felt like somebody was like, can you create a track that sounds like Kenny?
I mean, missed opportunity to not get Wings Hauser to sing any of them, but
yeah,
fair enough.
But as the portal opens up, she and the police that are in pursuit of her all end up accidentally driving through the dimensional portal, which on the LA side is just the dead end of an alleyway. It's just a mm-hmm. wall. So she and the cops were planning on just driving straight into a wall, except they end up going through it. And of course, they're immediately confronted with Arklon. Jackie drives away into the desert, but Arklon scares the cops into jumping back through the portal and leaving their police interceptors behind. And this is where we get the scene where Lirana has to explain to him that it's pronounced car, not dar. So Jackie drives miles and miles out into the flat, roadless desert in the dark. Her car runs out of gas, and then she just gets out and walks. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And out here, she ends up meeting up with Dar, the Beastmaster. I think she is woken up because the tiger is licking her hand.
Yeah.
And it's one of those weird things. I feel like there are dynamics like this in other sort of worlds colliding movies where the character just doesn't seem to realize they are in an alternate world full of magic, even though mm-hmm. it should be obvious. She keeps saying things like, does AAA have service out here? And then she meets Dar. She's like, are you a biker or something? Oh, another one was, you know, she's like, my daddy will pay you to get me back to LA or even to just get me to a 7-Eleven. And he's like, 7-Eleven. But then he says, okay, you may join me on my journey westward. Perhaps there you will find the land you seek. So, of course, they're going to become fast friends because mm-hmm. it's not exactly a buddy cop movie because it's not cops, but it's like a buddy barbarian movie. It's time buddies. Oh, and another thing I thought was funny here is so she gets acquainted to Dar and his animals, and she's like all impressed by the relationship he has with all the animals, though she's freaked out by the tiger and she's grossed out by the ferrets, calling them rats. But I was confused by this because ferrets are not a mythical animal. There are ferrets back on Earth.
I guess you just never seen them before.
Yeah.
So like how some people grow up thinking unicorns are real and then, you know, they're disappointed to find out it's not the case. Some people find out that ferrets are real and it's, I guess, a magical time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So they end up scampering around all over the desert. Dar shows her how to eat roots to survive, and she mm-hmm. says, no, thanks, I'll stick with the salad bar. and then there's a very weird and funny scene where Dar lets Jackie hold his ferrets.
Yeah, yeah. This is one of those great creepy animal guy sequences. One thing that is kind of neat about their relationship is, unless I'm forgetting something, they never set up any kind of like romantic connection between these two.
Not really. I think there is a brief and very chaste kiss at the end. She just kind of pecks him on the face. But yeah, otherwise it's just portrayed as a friendship.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, you know, they wander around making friends, but eventually Beastmaster and Jackie are attacked by Arklon's goons, and they disable Dar with some kind of neon yellow little, like, gas bomb thing, and then they kidnap her, basically so that Lyrana and Arklon can use her as a guide to the world of L.A. to show them where the supposed neutron detonator is. And in this scene, she's still doing her, like, riffing. She's like, what am I, in the Twilight Zone?
Yeah.
And she keeps calling Arklon Leatherface, which I thought was pretty good.
Yeah, there's another point where I think, like, a random punk on the street calls him Darth Vader. And he's, of course, he's, again, Wingshauser just playing the character very straight, and is just, you know, confused or bewildered or, you know, slightly angered by all of this, but never really gets the jokes.
Yeah, at one point he's like, Leatherface, what do you mean? But of course, they go through the portal of time, which deposits them in a dead-end alleyway, and then Dar chases them, and Arklon ends up trapping Dar in the alleyway by blowing up a gas pipe that sends a jet of fire screaming across the width of the alley. And I was like, oh, that's funny, because I feel like that is a common method used to prevent your progress in a certain direction in a video game.
Yes,
you need to go somewhere else first.
Definitely encountered that before.
Oh, sorry, there's a jet of fire here. You got to go find a way to turn it off.
Yep.
get the key card access.
And you always have to shut it off yourself. You can't just, like, call the gas company, which would be the thing to do.
Right. So eventually the police show up in this in the alleyway. And so here's Dar with his animals. And we meet Lieutenant Coberly, again played by James Avery of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And he again plays this weary, no-nonsense police commander who has this creepy little underling in a bow tie. And they in a very sad moment, they tranquilize Rude the tiger. They shoot him with a tranquilizer dart, and he passes out. And I'm sure that's very traumatic for Dar, because Dar doesn't know about tranquilizer darts. He probably thinks his loyal tiger friend has been killed. But never fear, Rue will be back later in the movie. Dar himself gets tased and taken to the police station. And then next up is, I would say, a real standout, one of the most memorable sequences of the film, the clothes shopping scene.
Yeah.
So thinking back on it, I know it's not really this way if you measure it, but my general impression in retrospect was that the makeover clothes shopping scene where Arklon, Lyrana, and Carrie Werwer go into the fashion store takes up approximately the middle third of the movie.
Yeah, it goes on for quite a while. We keep jumping back to it. There's a lot of shopping to be done here.
Yeah, and so they go into a store. I think Lyrana's like, we need clothes so we can fit into the modern world. And Arklon is, of course, just being violent and menacing in the men's section. But Lyrana is clearly interested in trying some things on.
And then she finds just like a smashing blue dress that she tries.
Yeah, she's all about fashion, and, you know, she looks great. But also it's funny because Jackie escapes while Arklon is literally trying on clothes. He goes into the fitting room, and she's just like, okay, out of here, and runs out the door. And then when Arklon comes out and discovers she has left, he gets so mad and he destroys the store with his key of Magog. Meanwhile, Lyrana runs out on her own in a fabulous new outfit, which I don't think she paid for.
Oh, yeah, I don't think so either. And I guess Arklon makes it out in this green jacket or overcoat that he tries on. Like, he only tries on the one thing, but he does seem taken with it. There's this great scene with him kind of, posing in front of the mirror, and it's a nice moment where one of the many moments, I guess, where Arklon comes off of as a doofus, despite Wingshauser playing the role very straight.
Yes.
So I like that moment.
This looks wonderful on me.
I look so terrifying in this little green coat. What color is this? I've never seen it in my, my home dimension.
That's true. In my world, we only have orange clothes. he is wearing this green jacket, and to be honest, doesn't look that great on him. It's kind of a baggy fit. It just doesn't look right.
He doesn't know fashion. He doesn't know fashion, Joe.
There's also an interrogation scene. So you cut back to Dar in the police station, and Lieutenant Coberly is asking him all these questions. But in a true mob movie fashion, Dar keeps his mouth shut. He says nothing.
It's like one of those scenes where, like, a real hardened criminal's like, yeah, I don't snitch, I don't talk to cops.
Yeah.
But I don't understand, like, where he gets this attitude. Like, he's just, it's like we're in that movie, but there's no reason for the Beastmaster to be that kind of hard? Like, what interactions with the police is he having back in his home dimension?
Yeah, and also, I mean, he's lucky enough that they went to another dimension where people also speak English, so everybody understands each other. Why not just explain things to them?
Yeah.
Try your luck.
It would have been funny if he was just like, lawyer. I want a lawyer. Yeah.
The demand right of counsel. Yeah, and they bring a lawyer from the fantasy world. It's like a guy in a druid robe.
Oh, yeah, like David Warner pops up. That would be great. That would have been
It's one of the brain guys from the first scene. But he ends up escaping the police station. He gets into Jackie's car because she just happens to pull up outside right when he's leaving. And then here for a while, we get a big stretch of the movie where it just turns into Jackie and Dar doing fish out of time gags. Mm-hmm. So we get Dar discovers rock and roll. He says it's like an earthquake. He's kind of afraid of it at first, but then I think he kind of likes it.
Yeah, that's how it goes.
Yeah, and then Dar discovers fancy food. Jackie takes him back to her mansion where they meet her snooty butler, and the butler gives them fancy food, and Dar is like, "Oh, it is delicious, but is it to eat or to look upon?" Then you also get Dar discovers daytime TV. Dar learns about cussing. It's good stuff.
You know, this does remind me briefly another almost literal fish out of water film that was a lot of fun. I haven't seen it in forever, but I remember enjoying the 1984 romantic comedy Splash, in which Daryl Hannah plays a mermaid opposite Tom Hanks.
Mm, I've never seen it.
Oh, it's just like fun stuff where like she's literally a mermaid who's lost her legs. You know, very much lost her fish parts, and you know now has legs. But there's a scene where he takes her to a fancy restaurant and she orders like a lobster and she starts eating it whole. Great scene.
Oh, that's pretty good. Oh, I like how Dar invites, you know, he's got his ferrets and he invites the eagle in, and there's a great eagle versus butler scene. But eventually they end up watching TV and they're watching the news, and I think there's something on the news about like somebody's trying to steal a neutron detonator, and they're like, oh, it's Archlon. We got to go get him. So the major scenes remaining are there's a big heist scene with the neutron detonator, with Archlon dressing up as a military guy to get into a secret base, and nobody makes note of the fact that he's got a Phantom of the Opera mask on under his general's hat.
Right. Oh, and this was also when he steals the clothing from the general, he also does some sort of telepathic mind meld where he steals all of his memories.
Yes.
So that he can better move around in this world. And it's one of these like third act magic powers where you're like, well, where was this magic power earlier when you first arrived in LA and were acting like a total doofus the whole time? Like maybe you should have used that then. And then also I was overthinking it, partially because I'm watching the excellent television show Severed right now. Mm-hmm. It made me think, well, if you absorb this guy's memories, like how does that work? Are those memories consolidated with your memories? Are you a different person now, Archlon? No, it doesn't seem to be the case. It seems like these new memories are compartmentalized somewhere.
Yeah. They're downloaded, kept in a different file folder.
Yeah, that seems to be how it works.
Oh, and so Wingshauser and Sarah Douglas meet back up in the military base because she's there also in disguise, I guess, to help him. Mm-hmm. But then there's a rift because he uses his new power again on her, like when they're about to escape with the thing. He like grabs her head and he's like, "Oh, you were going to kill me and take over after we got back. So, to heck with you." And he throws her out of the Jeep and drives off by himself. And here's her sort of hero turn. She turns from the nominal villain into a nominal ally. She sort of hooks up with Dar and Jackie and is like, "We've got to stop him." Mm-hmm. So because the neutron detonator has been taken, the police end up recruiting this guy who I was just calling the Kablooey guy. What was his deal?
He's like a retired general or something, but he knows how this device works, a device which is now ticking down. Because, you know, Archlon doesn't know how this works. It is going to explode in like an hour and then within half an hour. And then it's going to apparently destroy the entire world.
Yeah.
And this guy is our only hope at actually, because, you know, Beastmaster can stop Archlon, but still somebody needs to turn this device off.
But so it's this guy who just sits around saying like, kablooey, kablooey. But hey, if you were going to guess, they go to L.A., and the Beastmaster has to have a final showdown with the villain of the film. It's going to be somewhere in L.A. Where would you guess it would be in L.A.?
Oh, yeah. You know, there's so many great places that it could have been that they probably couldn't have gotten the film rights, location rights to. But they decide to go, like, I don't know, the tar pits would have been nice.
Okay. Yeah. But I feel like the choice they went with is kind of obvious because they go to the zoo.
Right. I thought it was going to maybe be the Scientology Celebrity Center, but instead it is the zoo. And
Archlon joins up. Yeah.
They really play it for laughs, though. Oh, my God. This zoo showdown. Like, it made me think back to Masters of the Universe, where we have all of our mid-movie fish out of time shenanigans, like, oh, what is this food on these sticks? That wonderful scene. But then at the end of it, we get this, like, dramatic. It's not really traumatic, I guess, unless you're a big Skeletor fan. This wonderful showdown between He-Man and Skeletor, where Skeletor becomes like a golden god, and it's really splendid and like ultimately kind of like high fantasy and epic and played mostly seriously. Here, though, it is a battle between Beastmaster and Archlon, whilst the animals watch on and hoot, whilst an audio track is playing describing a spiny anteater or something, or hedgehog, yeah, and a lion. It's just all played for goofiness.
And it's very goofy. Yeah, they have a sword fight. It's like the ground is cracking and full of fire. Like there's a, you know, volcanic earthquake underneath them.
Mm-hmm. And, cut to a chimpanzee clapping and laughing.
Yes. But then finally there are so many moments where, like, you know, you got to have the thing where the hero gets the better of the villain or disarms them or something. And then they're like, you can still live. And the villain is like, no, I must do evil and die. Mm-hmm. And so that happens. I think literally Wingshauser says, I hate peace.
Yeah. There's a nut clutch in there.
Yeah, that's good. And then finally, Dar ends up throwing Wingshauser into the crack in the earth. And as he's plunging down into the fire, he just yells, the world is mine.
Yeah, he's like, I am winning so hard, as he falls to his flaming death, which I believe is the same way Rip Torn's villain died in the first film, falling into a sacrificial fire.
So, they get the Kablooey and the guy in there to disarm the neutron detonator. And then we get to say our emotional goodbyes between Dar and Jackie, because of course, you know, she must stay in her world and he must return to his. But Dar decides, you know what, Jackie and my ferrets, they have become such good friends. I'm going to let the ferrets stay. So Kodo and Podo, the ferrets, are West Coast ferrets now. and then there's a great stinger at the end, which is when Dar goes back to his own universe, Jackie Trent's red sports car, her Porsche, is sitting in the desert still. And now it is an object of pilgrimage for the people of the Beastmaster world.
Yeah, and this is where Berryman shows up, is one of the lead pilgrim that's talking. It's like, come see this wondrous device that was left by the gods in the desert.
Yeah.
We all want to know how it works.
Oh, and then the desert pilgrims, they learn how to dance after they activate the stereo system and it starts playing hair metal and you see them kind of like swaying.
Yeah.
one last question I have about the plot. Do we ever find out what happens to Lyrana at the end? I don't remember.
No. I don't know if the scene was cut or what, but I don't think she died or anything. Sometimes you see that where the villain or the, you know, a villainous character has a hero turn, but they still have to pay the price for their misdeeds. But I think she just vanishes. We don't see what happens to her.
She's just living on in L.A.
Yeah. And more power to her. She'll fit right in. But the final moment is also a lot of fun. I don't know if you caught all the details of this, but the eagle cries, and Dar must now run off into the sunset. This, you know, wonderful sunset in the background here, with his tiger beside him, you know, to fight another day and carry on adventures and so forth. But it quickly becomes clear, even as credits are beginning to roll, that this sunset is, of course, a matte painting, and. Uh-huh. And the tiger moves up a little bit, but then stops and kind of looks around and then walks off screen. Meanwhile, Mark Singer in the Beastmaster garb has run up as close as he can and is basically just running in place for I guess, the duration of the credits there, kind of moving back and forth. But there's nowhere else for him to run. He's just running in place.
Wow. I did not catch that. That's
very good. It's worth going back and watching.
Okay. So I'd say in the end about Beastmaster 2, Not a great film overall, but Wingshauser is fun. Sarah Douglas is transcendent. The ferrets are very cute. And this was a really fun episode of Weird House.
Yeah, this one was a lot of fun. It's a love letter to L.A., this film. but also, I will say that, hey, if anyone out there is a Beastmaster 1 purist and you're like, I don't want any part of this film, traveling to L.A., no. I want to advise you, give Beastmaster 2 a chance because, it's not Beastmaster 1. It's its own thing. It's goofy. It's dumb. But it is, it's tremendous fun. Now, unfortunately, there aren't a lot of great ways to watch this film in decent quality right now. For instance, Vinegar Syndrome put out an absolutely beautiful Blu-ray of The Beastmaster a few years back. Like, one of these was just beautiful packaging and original artwork and so forth. They did not give the same treatment to Beastmaster 2. I believe there is a DVD edition from Cargo Records out there that you can easily buy at a very affordable price. So far, that's it. There's no Blu-ray release of this film as of this recording. But hey, hopefully the future will prove me wrong. All right. If you want to check out other episodes of Weird House Cinema, you'll find it every Friday in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We're generally, a science podcast. We're more concerned with, say, like the consolidation of memory or the, or even the speculative time travel and the limitations involved there. But on Fridays, we put most of those serious matters aside and we consider a film such as Beastmaster 2, which a film that may raise some of these questions, but does not require intensive research to answer.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.